This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on May 31st, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. I'd like to convene an open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, May 31st, 2007. The first item on our agenda is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the minutes of an open meeting of the Federal Election Commission of Thursday, February 3rd, 2007, as set forth in agenda document 0736.
Okay. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. The second item on our agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2007-07 involving Craig for U.S. Congress. We have Mr. Tony Buckley and Ron Catwan from the General Counsel's Office. Mr. Buckley, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Craig for U.S. Congress, by its counsel, requested the advisory opinion before you in Agenda Document 0738. The request asks whether Craig for Congress may amend its disclosure reports to report funds received from its candidate, James W. Craig, as loans rather than as contributions, and whether Craig for U.S. Congress may accept contributions to pay off these loans. The draft concludes that, based on the evidence provided, the funds provided by Mr. Craig to his principal campaign committee were, in fact, loans by him to the committee, and that the committee may accept contributions to pay off these loans. The draft notes that any contributions accepted may only be an amount sufficient to retire the full amount of the debts, that contributions must be aggregated with contributions made by the same person in the 2006 election cycle, and that the contribution limits, in effect, or those of the 2006 election cycle. The draft also requires Craig for U.S. Congress to amend its reports on file with the Commission to accurately reflect the nature of the funds provided by Mr. Craig to Craig for U.S. Congress. Thank you, and I'd be happy to address any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Buckley. We appreciate that. Any comments or questions? Seeing none, any motions? But Mr. Vice Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that Mr. Reif will report to his client that the commission was broken up by the request. At least the council was. And I would move approval of the draft advisory opinion 2007-07.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of draft advisory opinion 2007. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you can record, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Thank you very much, Mr. Buckley, for persevering. Appreciate it. The third item on our agenda is a statement of policy regarding Treasurer's best efforts to obtain, maintain, and submit information as required by the Federal Election Campaign Act. We have a late submitted document, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider the draft policy statement on best efforts.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have Margaret Pearl and Ron Catwan presenting today. Ms. Pearl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Agenda Document 0741 is a draft policy statement regarding Treasurer's best efforts to obtain, maintain, and submit information as required by the Federal Election Campaign Act. In this policy statement, the Commission clarifies its enforcement policy with respect to the best efforts defense under Commission's regulation at 11 CFR 104.7. The policy statement explains that the Commission intends to consider a committee's affirmative steps to keep adequate records and make accurate reports, as well as the reasons for its failure to obtain, maintain, or submit information properly when considering this best efforts defense. The policy statement includes detailed guidance to committees regarding what evidence the Commission intends to consider sufficient to demonstrate that the best efforts defense has been satisfied. This policy statement does not affect the Commission's administrative fines program, but applies only to matters in the enforcement, audit, and ADR programs. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any comments, questions? Seeing none, any motions? Mr. Vice Chairman.
I move approval of the draft policy statement.
Okay. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Congratulations. Thank you. You know, Commissioner Weintraub reminded me, I was going to make an announcement at the very beginning. For those following on our agenda, we are reordering the agenda, some of the later items in the agenda to accommodate some staffing issues here at the agency. And so we will be, we are going to flip the order of the two audits. So the item which is now marked item number 6, the Carey Edwards final audit report, we will do before we do item number 5, which is the report of the audit division on the Gebhardt for President committee. So just so as not to surprise anyone later as we go along, we will be approaching things in a slightly different order than is on the blue documents. The next item on our agenda is a notice of proposed rulemakings for federal election activity and non-federal elections. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have another late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0742.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion is adopted by a vote of 5-0. We again have Margaret Pearl and Ron Catwan presenting on this one as well. Ms. Pearl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document 0742 is a draft notice of proposed rulemaking for federal election activity and non-federal elections. In March 2006, the Commission published an interim final rule redefining the definition of the phrase in connection with an election in which a candidate for federal office appears on the ballot, which applies to Type 2 FEA. The interim final rule specified when voter identification and GOTV activities are in connection with non-federal election instead of a federal election and are therefore not Type 2 FEA. The interim final rule expires on September 1, 2007. The proposed rule in the agenda document would make permanent the interim final rule with some stylistic and technical changes explained in the NPRM. In the NPRM, the Commission seeks public comment on whether non-federal candidates or state, district, and local parties conducted voter identification and GOTV activities under the exemption in the interim final rules during the 2006 election cycle. The Commission also invites commenters to suggest modifications of the proposed rule based on their experience, if any, with the exemption in the last election. In addition, the NPRM seeks public comment regarding the specific requirements of the proposed exemption. The proposed exemption would apply to voter identification or GOTV activities that are conducted solely in connection with a non-federal election held on a date separate from any federal election, and that involve a communication that refers exclusively to non-federal candidates participating in the non-federal election, ballot initiatives or referenda in the non-federal election, or the date, polling hours, or polling locations of the non-federal election. The public comment period would run for 30 days after publication in the Federal Register. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any questions? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's just one thing I'd like to say about this, and that is, I mean, the job that we do in regulating federal elections is a very important one, but we have to be very careful that we don't federalize activities that are solely in connection with state and local elections. That is the purpose of this rule. And I would, there were a dearth of comments, unfortunately, when we passed the interim rule. And I would solicit the public and members of the regulated community, and particularly local and state political parties on all sides, to send us comments on this, because as I said, it's a very important issue that we stay within our jurisdiction of regulating federal elections and that we don't unnecessarily, outside of the statute, federalize what are activities solely in connection with local, particularly municipal elections. And I would ask those people who are here today or in the regulated community to send us comments about what you think on this rule. Thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to join in Commissioner Von Spakovsky's urging that people will send us comments, particularly those who had experience with how this rule worked. I personally did not vote for the interim final rule. I had some concerns at the time about possible carryover effects on the federal elections, but you know, I remain open-minded at this juncture, and I will be influenced by comments, and I would be really interested in hearing from the people who were closest to it. How did it work? Did it work well? Did it not work well? Were there unforeseen side effects of this rule, or you know, was it a great thing all around? And I like Commissioner Von Spakovsky, I hope we get more comments this time than we got on the interim final rule, and people will be in a better position now to tell us how it worked in practice, and I hope that they do.
Very good. Thank you. Other comments, questions, suggestions, motions? Mr. Vice Chairman, you're on a roll this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move, let's see the recommendation here.
0742.
That we approve the interim final rule, direct counsel's office publish in the Federal Register as described.
Well, that's not exactly what agenda document. 0742.
I'm sorry. We approve the draft notice of proposed rulemaking for publication in the Federal Register as described.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has moved adoption of and publication of Agenda Document 07-42 in the Federal Register. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you can record that the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0 yet again. And I wanted to take a moment to thank specifically Rosie Smith. We've moved through a number of items very quickly on this morning or this afternoon's agenda that fall within her jurisdiction of supervision, and that is not because these are simple problems to solve or documents to produce, but because of an enormous amount of hard work by her staff and herself, and I wanted to express our appreciation for that. Thank you. The next item on our agenda is going to be the Carrie Edwards 2004 audit report. And we have a number of people. We have Tom Northern, Mary Moss, and Joe Stoltz from the Staff Director's Office. We have Delaney Painter and Larry Calvert from the General Counsel's Office. And so I will leave to you who presents first. I would like to note that the next two items on our agenda involve the approval of audit reports. There was some press on these in the last day or so, and I just thought it would be helpful to highlight where we are in the process. These audits were of the presidential campaigns. The next two audits were the presidential campaigns in 2004, and this audit activity began in 2005. I guess the committees began preparing the record, getting the records together in 2004, but the field work, the records production, a lot of the legwork in these audits happened in 2005, and there was a preliminary audit report that was produced that we voted on in 2006. The committee has had a chance to interact with our staff on this throughout, including commenting on our findings in the preliminary audit report. And to submit additional information and arguments to our staff, which has led our staff to produce the draft audit reports we have before us today, which we will vote on. I guess the thing I wanted to make clear is that this is not the end of the process. After we complete our work today, the committees will have an opportunity to file a request for administrative review of our findings today. And they will have an opportunity for a public hearing to raise the arguments they have here as well. But this is the first step in the process, which is in the public. And so I think it provides helpful clarity on that. Only after, if they request a public hearing, only after that do we then reach a decision by a vote of what the repayment determination is. and we would then issue statements of reasons that would flow from that. So while I think we are at an important part of the process, and certainly the fact that it is now open to the public is important, we are not at the end of the road on this. And so with that bit of context, I will turn to either our auditors or our general counsel to begin.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to note before we defer to the audit vision, but we do have a late submitted document from our office in the Kerry Edwards.
Very good. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider a memorandum from the general counsel.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record that the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Thank you, Mr. Calvert. Mr. Northern, welcome.
Welcome. Before the Commission today is the final audit report on Kerry Edwards 2004 Inc. and Kerry Edwards 2004 General Election Legal and Accounting Compliance Fund. With respect to the Kerry Edwards General Committee, there are five findings which required the committee to respond to. They are interest earned, expenditure limitation, undocumented media expenditures, disclosure of debts and obligations, and stale data checks. There are then five additional issues which did not require response by the committee. Following that is the there are two matters concerning the compliance fund. They are impermissible contributions and also stale data checks. We will gladly entertain any questions the commission may have.
Very good. Thank you. Council, any thoughts, comments?
Nothing in addition.
No, as a finance. I have a number of points in which my thinking deviates from the document we have in front of us, and I'm going to I'd like to talk through those. For those who have not experienced an audit, the issues tend to be somewhat technical or arcane, and I apologize for that. There are really five different points that I want to raise or issues I want to take with this. The first relates to the conclusion relating to whether the GLAC can pay its media consultant for reconciliation costs. A GLAC is a general election legal and accounting compliance fund. And our regulations allow campaigns to create GLACs that can pay for certain expenses. I think the General Election Committee of the Kerry Edwards campaign, which I'll refer to sometimes as the General Committee or the GC, persuasively argues that GLAC properly paid for two costs here, certain wind-down costs and certain computer costs. Our regulations provide that a GLAC may pay to, quote, defray winding down expenses for legal and accounting compliance activities incurred after the end of the expenditure report period. The other way these kinds of costs are paid for is as general operating expenses of the campaign. The first thing I want to take issue with is $100,000 that was due to the media consultant for reconciliation and record keeping services under the contract between the media vendor and the campaign. The contract specified that $100,000 of the sums that were paid were to be reserved for the costs incurred by the media consultant, and I'm quoting the contract now, to complete the required reconciliation and other related record-keeping requirements for, and then they cite provisions of the contract that deal with media buys, station affidavits, and documentation of all refund from canceled buyers by November 2nd, 2005, end of quote. I find the General Committee's argument persuasive that this expense was for post-election audit-related activities that fall within the category of wind-down expenses that may be paid for by the GLAC rather than as campaign operating expenditures. I find the November 2, 2005 date in the contract significant in showing what the parties intended. That date is a year after the election, at which point the campaign's only activities would have been complying with FECA and responding to our agency's audit And the contract specifically refers to this sum being used to pay for activities that are associated with the FEC's review of the GC's spending. My conclusion is that this $100,000 expenditure was appropriately designated as a wind down or compliance cost, and that the GLAC properly paid for it. The second issue where I depart from the document in front of us relates to the decrease in excess compliance fund reimbursement for shared overhead. Under our rules, a GLAC may also pay for a certain percentage of a campaign's computer costs. Here, the campaign allocated 85% of the computer costs associated with its accounting office to the GLAC as a compliance cost. The draft audit report concludes that this is the correct percentage for all of the other accounting office costs, but takes the position that the accounting office's computer costs must be allocated at a 50% rate. I think the committee's approach is more in accord with a plain reading of our compliance manual, which states, and I quote, "A committee may allocate 85% of payroll, payroll taxes, overhead, and other costs which relate to the operation of its accounting office, and 50% of the computer expense as an exempt compliance," end of quote. The manual goes on to make clear that computer costs charged to the accounting office must not include costs related to fundraising or general campaign management. The presence of this exemption supports the committee's interpretation that accounting-related computer costs are not subject to the 50% limit, and I would approve the GLAC's payment of 85% of the costs of computer expenses that relate to the operation of the accounting office. The third item where I depart from the draft relates to allowing capital asset depreciation for Senator Kerry's 527 decal costs. Here again, I also believe that the committee has made a good argument that how they paid for most of the these costs was a reasonable interpretation of our regulations. The primary committee paid $63,000, or slightly more than that, for making and installing decals on the outside of Senator Kerry's plane. Such expenditures are treated as capital assets under 11 CFR 9004.9. If that asset is transferred from the primary committee to the general election committee, Section 9004.9 provides that the value of the asset, quote, "shall be considered to be 60% of the original cost of such item," end of quote. This is a bright line rule and one that we have generally applied, including in considering the decal costs of the plane the campaign used for Senator Edwards' travel. Although it appears that third-party problems prevented Senator Kerry's plane from flying before the convention, the committee should be able to budget ahead of time without being vulnerable to a third party's mistake throwing the committee's allocation into jeopardy at the last minute. While the general committee is advantaged by this approach here, we know that in adopting a bright line rule, there would be times when a general committee would be advantaged and other times when it would be disadvantaged by that rule. Overall, though, I believe the campaign's approach of treating the decal costs for the Kerry Edwards plane similarly using our regulation at 9004.9 is not unreasonable. The fourth item where I depart from the draft relates to excluding labor from the reconfiguration costs for both the Kerry and the Edwards planes. In allocating the cost of the plane's reconfiguration to the General Committee, the campaign included only the cost of purchasing the property at issue, but not the cost of additional labor services. The campaign points to our capital asset rules, which emphasize that they concern the cost of property owned by the committee. Capital asset is defined as, quote, "any property used in the operation of the campaign whose purchase price exceeds $2,000 when acquired by the committee," end of quote, quoting there from 11 CFR 9004.9 D1. As examples, the regulations state that property that must be treated as capital assets includes, quote, "office equipment, furniture, vehicles, and fixtures acquired for use in the operation of the candidate's campaign," end of quote. The Commission has never ruled on whether labor and installation services subsequently incurred should be factored into the, quote, "original cost," end of quote, of the property. While I do not fault the auditors for this approach, I'm disinclined to read beyond our regulatory definition of capital assets and property to include what are essentially services. Therefore, I believe the draft report is incorrectly assigning the installation cost to the General Committee beyond the regulatory definition, and I'm uncomfortable with adopting this approach. While I would be comfortable expanding the definition going forward, I don't think it's proper to order a campaign to repay money as a result of a reasonable interpretation of our regulations. Lastly, I would amend the findings concerning the failure to disclose debts. The committee has now filed amendments to its debt schedules in response to our recommendations in the PAR, so I think we should amend finding 4 to indicate the committee's compliance with our recommendations. Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with your analysis, and I will not subject the audience to my repeating what you've already so articulately stated. I just wanted to say that, sort of as a general matter, both before I got here and certainly since I've been here, the Commission's practice in reviewing these audits of publicly funded campaigns has been, I think, a reasonable one, and that is that there are, you know, it's a thick book of regulations. These aren't all relevant to the, I think we have a new color out, but I have the old one. Not all the regulations are relevant to the presidential funding system, but a lot of them are. And as is always the case, there are issues that come up, and reasonable people could disagree on how one might interpret the regulations, what might be the best interpretation of the regulations. And the Commission historically, and certainly since I've been here, has been inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to campaigns that are obviously operating in real time, and then, you know, we come in after the fact and audit them, and if there's a reasonable, if what the campaign did was guided by a reasonable interpretation of the regulations, the Commission has historically not ordered repayment because there might be another interpretation of the regulations. You know, we could do it differently. We could send our auditors out in real time during the campaigns and on these publicly funded campaigns and have them advise the campaigns in real time as to how they ought to do these things. I think that would really have an impact on the presidential funding system if we said that was a requirement. But that's not the way we've done it. We do audit after the fact, and that has certain consequences in looking at things. And for me, one of the guiding principles is that we treat different candidates comparably, that to the extent that we have been reasonable with candidates in the past, that we continue to be reasonable with candidates unless we're going to announce that we're suddenly going to do something differently. So I think that your reading of the audit report and of the General Committee's response to it and your interpretation of how the rules ought to be applied to them is a reasonable one, and it's consistent with the kind of approach that the Commission has showed in the past, and I support it.
Thank you. Other comments, suggestions, thoughts? Commissioner Von Spakov, or Vice Chairman Mason.
I'm still trying to parse out whether the chairman is favoring labor or capital in his method of analysis.
I think, boy, this takes me back. Doesn't capital all derive from labor? Isn't labor in the first instance the source of all wealth? I don't know. We'll have to see whether anyone can draw better upon their long ago readings of Marx than I. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about these. And I should tell you, first of all, I agree with two of your issues. One, I do think the $100,000 paid by the GLAC fund was okay, that those were winding down costs. And I certainly agree that we should amend the finding about the debt since they've now amended that. But the question I've got for you, and I'll be the first to say these audits are extremely complex, and applying our accounting rules to them are extremely complex. But the issue you've got about the cost of the computers, I read what you'd presented on this, and frankly, I don't quite understand it. And that's why I want to ask you about it. Because, the compliance manual says A committee can allocate 85% of payroll taxes, overhead, and other costs which relate to the operations of the accounting office, and 50% of computer expenses. Now, general, my understanding of, you know, statutory interpretation, regulatory interpretation is that a general term like other costs doesn't overwhelm a specific term like computer costs. And so, I mean, in the same sentence, we're saying, yeah, 85% for payroll taxes, overhead, and other costs, but specifically with regard to computer expenses, 50%. So I don't understand how you get to ignoring, I mean, because it seems like that position ignores that you're saying 50% of computer expense, and you just include computer expense in the other costs, and I don't quite see how you get there.
I appreciate that, and I think that, just to begin, I think that there are with on all of these things that there are multiple reasonable interpretations, and I think the staff took a contrary one, and I think that there's a logic to it. I think that this is a somewhat better reading, because I think that the 50% reference to computer expenses encompasses computer expenses beyond those, or would talk about computer expenses beyond those in an accounting office. And that's why I find the subsequent sentence modifying that to say the computer costs charged to the accounting office must not include costs related to fundraising or general campaign management doesn't make sense, to the degree that if the first sentence were to be interpreted that computer costs could only be at 50%, the second sentence wouldn't be necessary. It would make no sense to include it in there. It would only make sense to include it in there if the computer costs of an accounting office could be allocated at the 85% level, so long as those, you know, accounting office computers were not used for fundraising or general campaign management. And that's why I found the subsequent sentence to indicate, or reasonably be read to indicate, that computer costs associated with the accounting function could be charged at the higher 85% rate, but that other computer costs could not be. They could at most be charged at the 50% rate, and that the modifier, that the subsequent sentence was made that clear that you could not use that as a way to get around and use your accounting office computers for fundraising or campaign management as a way to sort of circumvent that exemption or higher percentage.
If I may, sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to get clarification of where in the regulations the 85% figure comes from.
The regulation addresses 10% of payroll taxes and overhead associated with the national campaign as well as the state offices. Further down in the regulation, Section F addresses the alternative approach laid out in the compliance manual itself. So the regulations only address 10% across the board for payroll taxes and overhead. The alternative to that is the a compliance manual.
If I could just,
yeah, please
probe on that point, I see the 10%. I also see in 9003.3 IID the 50% of computer costs, and the reason I'm asking this is because it bears on what goes in what pot, because the F section that Tom just referred to, and the B section just above, to defray that portion of expenditures for payroll, overhead, and computer services related to ensuring compliance is in one part of the regulations, and then a completely different part of the, not completely different, but I mean a distinct subsection of the regulations, we have 50% of computer costs. And that structure would suggest to me that the chairman's argument has some weight, because we refer to computer services in two different places. One where it is linked with payroll, overhead, and computer services related to ensuring compliance. That falls in the 85% pot. And then later in the regulations a different section saying 50% of the costs other than payroll associated with computer services. So that seems to me to bolster the chairman's argument. If this first section is where the 85% provision comes from, that that computer services for ensuring compliance fall into the higher proportion and not under the 50% rule.
It's a sad point in the meeting where I think that I will mention to the audience that copies of the Yellow Book are out in the hall, and to the degree that people, you've reached this point, and we're not anywhere close to done with the agenda. The notion that folks are going to have to bring their reg books back into the room to keep going on this is sadly a journey into the world in which we live too frequently. I guess one can draw different interpretations. I just think that the one that the general committee has taken in this point, on this issue is a reasonable one, or is not unreasonable. Commissioner Von Spakovsky,
has this issue come up before in a previous audit?
Since the compliance manual laid out the 85-15 for the national headquarters accounting office and 50% for computers, I don't believe we've ever addressed it.
I would also note that Section F, where it talks about the alternative in the compliance manual, refers only to salaries and overhead. It doesn't refer to computer costs. The computer cost section has no alternative in the compliance manual, and it's at 50%.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Unless Vice Chairman Mason has another question about that, I wanted to ask you about one of your other issues, if I may.
Please.
That's the decals. If I understand what you're saying, I think, you're saying that you want to allow capital asset depreciation of the decals.
Correct.
All right. The problem I have is I guess I don't see how a decal is a capital asset. You know, it's not like an airplane, a piece of equipment you can sell and reuse. I mean, decal can't be reused. And, I mean, I was struck by the fact that in the audit on page 20, the audit division makes clear that there was no evidence that the aircraft was even used during the primary period. So, again, I'm not quite sure how you're arriving at considering this to be a capital asset when, there's no evidence it was used during the primary at all, and it doesn't seem like a decal would be a capital asset.
Right, and I think that you raised two interesting points, and the first is treatment as an asset. We've done this before with some of these other decals, with these sort of things that are attached to the planes, and then become part of them. It seemed to fit somewhat better into that approach than into the single-use expendable travel costs, and so we've sort of proceeded with them, I guess, in that category. I think the use issue which was raised, in the document is a reasonable one to struggle with, and certainly we did somewhat as well with the Edwards plane. And I guess my sense is that we have a regulation that talks about when these assets are acquired, and certainly the sense I have was that if the plane had been delivered, you know, or this had been done somewhat more timely, it would have been used somewhat more timely, but was not. And the question is whether we then try to sort of craft an exception to this rule in a way that would treat it differently. And I think it's, you know, a reasonable, you know, people can take different views on this, and there's a logic to them. But I think that the approach that was done here was not unreasonable. It did comply with the way that our regulation was drafted, and the outcome is somewhat anomalous, but that is, you know, that it seemed reasonable to take that approach, given the way the language of the regulation lies. And it also has the advantage of treating these you know, assets consistently, because the sort of anomalous, the anomaly that comes from treating them separately or differently is that they end up paying for these expenditures for the Carey plane and the Edwards plane differently. And for a campaign in the process of running, I think it's a little hard to predict that that's the appropriate outcome. Or that a repayment obligation would attach for having paid for them in a common way. And so this avoids, you know, the conclusion I've reached avoids that problem. One of the difficulties that we have, and one of the difficulties committees have in this process, is that we are now looking back on spending decisions that were made, you know, between 2 and 3 years ago. And at the time these activities are going on, you know, people are making decisions based upon how they think events will unfold. And I think in this particular case, they probably didn't unfold fully as anticipated. And it's and so that's, I think, you know, animates some of my thinking on the reasonableness of this approach. I think that the staff has presented an alternative, which, you know, there's a logic to as well. But this is the preferable approach to my mind. Commissioner Mazbakovsky, yes?
And the final issue, I think, is, and I mean, it's a little bit for you, Mr. Chairman, but also for our audit staff. I mean, the key issue and the final question is on whether, when figuring out the original cost of the plane, whether you include the labor costs in installing all the special equipment and other things that were put into it. And again, I my understanding from generally accepted accounting procedures and my knowledge of that, I'm not an accountant and I don't even play one on TV, but I used to deal with the accounting department when I was a corporate lawyer. And I mean, my understanding in the corporate world is very standard that if a corporation buys a piece of equipment, all of the costs of getting the equipment customized for whatever use the corporation is going to put into it, including the labor costs, is considered part of the original cost for depreciation purposes. I mean, is my understanding of that correct?
That is correct, and it goes back to one of the very basic tenets of accounting, and that is trying to match the expenses associated with an asset to the benefiting periods and the revenues that are generated, and that's exactly, of course, what we were attempting to do here. This configuration was used by both the primary and the general. A large chunk of the cost of it, of course, was labor, as is often the case with assets. Obvious example comes to mind is a building. You have a pile of materials, and then there's a lot of labor involved in making a building out of it. We do address this at least briefly in our compliance manual, where we say that when determining which assets qualify as capital assets, should include in the assets value the cost of delivery and setup. And, you know, that's been on our manuals for a very long time. And so we thought in this case it was the proper accounting for it to say, well, yeah, there were materials and there were labor. The end result was an asset, and the asset's value is the sum of the two.
Commissioner Walther?
Have you ever had any history where this labor has been excluded?
No, this has never
any of this? This is the first time this
been
has
before
happened.
It's before.
Yes, sir.
And I would like to say, as the report points out, that the General Committee purchased a number of assets from the Primary Committee right at the start of the expenditure report period, and there was no deduction for labor or engineering for those
assets.
What
would those be?
Pardon me?
What were some of those?
Computer equipment. I think the value was something in the neighborhood of $800,000 that they purchased at 60% of the cost.
And how much labor was that?
Very rarely will the invoice specify engineering or labor.
Yeah, and I guess I wanted to make clear my I don't dispute the approach that the audit staff has made as to the engineering costs. I mean, that part of the analysis, I didn't really understand what the objection was. But my sense is that these costs are additional costs. These aren't the costs that it took to build the computers, but instead they dealt with, and the question, I guess, for me to turn somewhat on what is the asset. I mean, and the assets that they were purchasing in this instance was, televisions and phones. Are those the assets that were transferred? And so I think that the reference to, general accounting standards and how this would be handled in the corporate, world is useful. And I think that at times the agency does, in fact, follow those kinds of standards in its analysis. I'm not sure we're entirely uniform on that. But I think that there's a, I certainly understand the approach that underlies that and why you get there. I do in my mind distinguish the issue related to the engineering costs from those related to the labor costs. Vice Chairman Mason?
Well, this is one where I'm not following the chairman, and let me just abstract completely from GAAP and so on like that. When I build a fence in my backyard, the cost of the boards and the nails is a small part of the cost of the fence. The biggest part of the cost of that fence is the people who come out and drill the holes and put the posts in the ground and string the fencing material or nail the boards up or whatever of that sort. And it looks to me like that's what we're talking about here, if I understand properly. That is a part of the cost of the fence to me. If the fence is used for farming purposes, in my case, it's part of a capital asset that goes there rather than a current expense. So it looks to me as if, what we're talking about is the committee bought, I don't know what, nice seats, bucket seats for the airplane, or I don't know exactly what it was, and it would have done them very little good to have the seats sitting there on the tarmac if they weren't able to install them in the airplane. And my general understanding is that the cost of installation would be a part of the capital cost that would be treated that way. Again, my familiarity is more with the tax code, I don't see why we wouldn't follow that treatment.
Yeah, and I guess the answer to that is that in looking at what our regulation. Oh, I'm sorry. Northern.
Go ahead.
No, you can.
I just wanted to add that when the general committee and the owner of the plane agreed that in lieu of the general committee paying to reconfigure this plane back to its original state for the sum of $60,000, the general committee sold the assets as well as the labor. They're selling the labor as well because they're selling the assets as a finished product. So that was part of the agreement between the general committee and the owner when these assets were sold.
I thought the owner wanted the assets out of the plane at the end of the lease.
Pardon me?
I thought the owner wanted the assets out of the plane at the end of the lease.
As the contract was originally stated and it signed by the primary and then passed on to the general, at the end of the campaign, the general committee had to reconfigure the plane back to its original state. They had to pay for the cost. The people doing the reconfigure were guaranteed 1,000 man hours, and there was a $10,000 charge for every day the plane was not in service. So in lieu of paying for all that, the general committee and the owner of the plane signed an agreement that the general committee would sell everything, would sell the plane's reconfigured assets back to the owner for a sum of $60,000.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
He is actually purchasing the assets that are in the plane, the seats, as they are reconfigured, which he is also then purchasing labor.
What my thinking turns on is looking at our regulations and the definition of what constitutes the capital assets. It's the property that is acquired for use in the campaign. And in this case, the property that was acquired was, I thought, primarily telephones and televisions and I guess in some cases other things as well. Those were the assets that were purchased, as would the purchase of the desks and you know, computer equipment. My sense is that this hasn't come up in the past, that we don't then add on the cost of you know, people moving the desks around the office or whatever they do with them. My thinking turned more on how the regulations focus on what the property was that defined the asset that was being purchased. Commissioner Von Spakovsky?
I guess the difference I'd point out here, Mr. Chairman, which I think is a very significant difference, is the primary cost, and again, Mr. Stoltz, correct me if I'm wrong, the primary costs here that we're talking about were the costs to have a telephone system installed in the plane. That's $224,000 of it, which is almost all of it. And a phone system, look, if I buy a telephone, it costs me almost nothing to install it because I just plug it in the wall. That is not true with an airplane. A telephone system, extensive telephone system for use by people flying an airplane, takes a lot of very specialized work to get it to work, because without that, it's useless. I mean, completely useless. And that to me says that this property, this capital asset, and which included this equipment in it, would have been unusable without the labor cost to install it.
The labor charge you're talking about here is a lot broader than installing the phone system. And there were custom seats, there were, I believe, some partitions, there were video systems, telephone systems. It was a fairly extensive remodeling of the inside of the airplane, which is not uncommon for the campaigns to want to do that.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, those are all the questions I had on the issues you'd raise. I did want to raise one other issue, though, and just to discuss it quickly, because I think it's important that we make this note, and that is that when we approved the Bush-Cheney audit, the issue of hybrid ads came up. These were ads that Bush-Cheney campaign split the cost 50-50 with the RNC, because these were ads that not only were in favor of trying to get people to vote for the president, but also mentioned other members of the Republican team, other Republican candidates, generic reference. And we did split on that opinion. I and Commissioner Mason, and although Commissioner Toner wasn't here for the final audit, he was here for the preliminary audits. I mean, we all believed that was a perfectly legal allocation based on both our regulations and prior precedent. If it had not been, then the campaign would have owed about $40 billion back to the Treasury. I would just like to point out that this audit has the exact same issue, because the Kerry campaign also did almost identical hybrid ads. They also split the cost 50-50 between the campaign and the DNC. And if that allocation was not correct, they would owe back over $11 million. Also, I believe that in this case, just as in the prior case, the splitting of those, the allocation of those funds 50-50 was absolutely correct. It was both campaigns followed our legal precedents, and that this really is not an issue. But I just wanted to point out that this was an issue in this audit as it was in the last one. Thanks.
Other thoughts, comments? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since Commissioner Von Spakovsky raised the dreaded hybrid ad issue, I think that both he and I voted consistently on those issues at the preliminary stage, and I had a different interpretation than he did. I mean, we voted the same way on the Bush audit as we voted on the Kerry audit. We disagreed on both of them, and had we voted out a $42 million repayment for the Bush-Cheney campaign on the basis of those hybrid ads, then I would be here today voting out an $11 million repayment for the Kerry campaign on the basis of similar ads, which were run, you know, about a quarter of the amount and after the Bush-Cheney campaign started that. They were responsive. But you were consistent, and I was consistent, and we remain consistent, and, you know, that's just sort of where we are. But as I said earlier, I think one of the hallmarks of all of this entire process for me is to make sure that we are consistent from one candidate to the next. And we are certainly treating both candidates consistently on this issue.
We are all looking forward to the hybrid ad rulemaking, where hopefully we will be able to move away from a position where we disagree to one of accord. And that is awaits us in the future. Other thoughts or comments or discussions on this? I'm sorry, Commissioner Walther. Yes, sir.
You mentioned something in your earlier comments about your willingness to move away from this interpretation in the future. I think it was in connection with the labor issue, but I can't remember for sure. But what was your thinking on that? That because there's uncertainty here on that particular issue, you would agree to a different approach in the future? Or maybe I misunderstood what you were saying then.
Yeah, I mean, I think with all of the, you know, a number of these issues, as we sort of struggle through ones, especially those that involve questions of first impression or where there's some ambiguity in our rules, I think it is far easier to sort of set out with some clarity how we think the rules should be interpreted than arriving several years later with an interpretation which may not, you know, which conflicted with reasonable interpretations that people drew at the time. So I think, anyway, Vice Chairman Mason.
I just wanted to go at that because I as I expressed, at least as to one of these, I can, in some cases, I just flat out agree with the chairman in terms of, at least as I understand it, the media consultant costs. I mean, just because it's paid to a media consultant, you know, if the media consultant can segregate their time out and show that some time had to be spent for record keeping and reconciliation, I think that's legitimate to the GLAC. And there are others where I very much agree that with the thrust of what the chairman said and what Commissioner Weintraub said, that if people have made this a reasonable judgment, the audit is not a particularly good place to come back and second guess that. But I just have to disagree about this labor issue, because if somebody's going to go out and buy a phone system for an airplane or buy a changed internal configuration for the airplane, in the normal course of things, they're going to go to a vendor and they're going to get a bill. It's going to be one bill, and that's going to be the bill for the equipment and the installation of the equipment. And that's how a buyer buying the thing is going to look at it. It's how they're going to value it for tax purposes, and I think this is one where, I mean, you know, it's an inventive legal argument. I know that's what lawyers are paid for, but it's not one that I think was is one that I view as kind of an arguable way to go about it, and I think we'd be making a mistake because we'd be taking and separating out costs that normally aren't separated. One suggestion that that I might make is that if the chairman is contemplating or Commissioner Weintraub making a motion to adopt the report with these changes, is whether they would consider leaving the labor costs in the repayment calculation at this point. If the Cary Committee wants to challenge that or other issues, they will have the opportunity to do so. And having raised this issue, then they would have a further opportunity to vet it and get any legal arguments about it, consider it ourselves at that stage. Whereas if we take it out now, we will not only not be able to consider it at the later stage, but we will have made, in essence, adopted a legal standard that will serve as a precedent for other things, and one that I think would be a bad precedent. And these other things I'm not worried about, but this one of splitting out the installation costs from the hardware costs, I think to the extent that we're dealing with publicly financed campaigns in the future, could be one that could get a lot bigger. You know, it'd be a lot bigger than a couple of $100,000 for just the one airplane. So I'd ask if they'd consider that and at least avoid today on a fairly brief discussion what I think would be a serious mistake, and at a minimum preserve our opportunity to come back and review that if assuming the committee asks for a review.
I think given the amount of money it's still at stake, even regardless of these items, we can be assured of that this is not the end of the journey on this particular matter. I don't have an immediate response. I have to think about it for a moment. Any other discussion? Commissioner Walther.
I just have a question on the decal issue too. Let me go back a little bit. There was quite a bit of comment by counsel for the campaign about the accounting method used in the new injection of an accounting standard, and I just thought maybe you could address that issue, for one. And then secondly, in the decal issue, this does seem to be a novel kind of situation, but how do you view the so-called bright line rule that we have in terms of acquiring for the primary? It's attributable to the primary. How do you respond to their arguments?
Well, with respect
to both of those respects,
with the decals, they are, of course, very similar. Maybe, having not seen them, don't know. Maybe identical items applied to two different airplanes. One was used a little in the primary, and then primarily in the general. Under the Commission's kind of simplified depreciation expense allocation system, even if you use it just a little, you get 40% in the primary, 40% in the general, and then there's sort of an assumed residual. The other one didn't get used at all in the primary. And since it didn't get used at all in a primary, then it seemed fairly clear that it's an expense of the general. And that's the way we did it. Now that may be a result that is driven by issues that arose with timely completion of the work on the one airplane, so they couldn't use it. Could well be. But the regulation we thought was fairly clear. If you use it in both, you can allocate it. If you don't use it in both, you can't.
What if you spent for the primary, but you never use it in the general for some reason? Plane wasn't available. Something happened, never got used.
Your primary expense.
If it was, well, I don't know that I necessarily agree. If it was bought for the general, Cary Edwards decals applied to a plane that they had intended to use, I think under the basic regulation, it wasn't used in a primary either. And I think it could be argued that it would still be a general election expense. Particularly given Cary Edwards, which was the general election ticket and applied to a plane intended to be used in the general. I think the problem you'd have there is if the plane didn't get used in either election, then you'd have to go and look at the intent, because you don't have any use at all. As far as the unique accounting theory, I think what they're referring to is our examination of standard accounting practice, which, you know, I admit we have not spoken to in any depth in the past. There hasn't been an occasion to. We do, in our, at least in our compliance manual, make reference to it, and briefly, but we do. And clearly, the calculation that the committee puts forward is a unique accounting theory as well. Then we can separate the parts and the assembly and deal with them separately, where the parts in the assembly being considered an asset is just standard practice in the accounting world and has been since before I studied the subject.
I always dread that moment in the conversation where we appear to have dueling unique accounting standards or independent accounting standards, and so but I think that Commissioner Walther's example also presented sort of the interesting hypothetical that depending a little bit on how you shift the relative parts of the use of these assets, that the standard the bright line rule and the 60-40 depreciation ratio can end up with this sort of very anomalous results where the value ends up being very disproportionate to how the actual percentages in our regs play themselves out, depending a little bit on circumstances that may be, you know, unique or singular to particular campaigns. I mean, I think that the my sense is, you know, I take to heart the Vice Chairman's suggestion that this raises sort of interesting and potentially broad-based issues that may be better fleshed out at a public hearing where we'll have where some of the other commissioners will have a little more time to think through the substance and implications of all of this, and where, quite frankly, for the first time we will actually be able to hear the arguments of the parties involved, and that may provide some additional clarity. So if we wanted to, if the sense was that this would be an issue better taken up after that additional information, I would be willing to, postpone a final resolution of this matter until that point. I think, as for those who know, they know. For those who don't, the chairman is barred from making motions here at the commission, and so Commissioner Weintraub will be the one who has to make any motion to make various amendments to all of this, to the degree that she agrees with me. But I think that she is. I'm sorry. Or you could, but I think that she would be willing to forestall a final resolution of that matter if my sense is that the feelings are strong on that. So anyway, enough said.
If we're ready for a motion?
We are. I think we are ready for a motion.
All right. It sounds to me like we have consensus, and that's always nice. Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the report of the Audit Division on Kerry Edwards 2004 and the Kerry Edwards 2004 GLAC, except to direct the audit staff to amend finding 4 to indicate the committee's compliance with our recommendation, and amend finding 2 as follows: to permit the committee to allocate to the GLAC a $100,000 payment to the media consultant for record keeping and reconciliation, to permit the committee to allocate to the GLAC 85% of computer costs that relate to the operations of the accounting office, and to permit the committee to allocate $25,241 to the primary committee for plain decal costs. And we will save for a later day the resolution of the labor cost issue.
Madam Secretary, was that clear enough to avoid me having to try and repeat it? Very good. I'm sorry.
I think Mr. Northern is seeking a clarification.
Okay.
Something.
Yes, please. Is it?
I was unsure of the labor costs. Did we say associated with the decals?
The labor issue dealt with reconfiguration. Off. Would you like to repeat that part of the motion so that the staff is clear on what their
The decal part that we would permit the committee to allocate $25,241 to the primary committee for plain decal costs.
Okay. Discussion on the motion. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
My only question, Mr. Chairman, is I think Commissioner Weintraub's motion, she didn't include the final issue you had talked about. Did I miss that? The amending the
finding concerning failure? I think that was the first.
It was in the beginning.
Did you include that?
Yes.
I think that was the first thing she raised.
That was in the beginning.
All right.
Amend finding four.
Thank you.
Okay. Other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. I'd like to thank our audit staff for their assistance in this matter. The next item on our agenda is a report of the Audit Division on the Gebhardt for President campaign. And on this matter, we have Tom Hintermeister, as well as Joel Stoltz is going to be remaining with us from the Staff Director's Office, as well as Delaney Painter and Larry Calvert, again, will be remaining with us from the General Counsel's Office.
Mr. Carey must be more popular than Mr. Gebhardt. Everybody's leaving.
I think they may have just hit their level of endurance. We'll be awarding copies of the regulations book to those who remain to the end. Would you like to proceed?
Sure. Good afternoon. Before us is the final audit report for the Gebhardt for President Committee from the 2004 cycle. The audit report contains four findings with recommendation that an amount due to the Treasury for approximately $479,000. Finding number one concerns the audit staff's determination that the committee received matching funds in excess of entitlement. This finding didn't appear in the preliminary audit report. There were some changes from the preliminary report to the final report that warranted this finding. Namely, winding down costs were lower than estimated. Amounts payable for excessive contributions were reduced as a result of the decision to cure certain excessive contributions by sending letters to contributors as opposed to refunds. Number three, an adjustment was made to accounts payable to exclude Iowa expenditures that were made over the Iowa expenditure limit and considered a non-qualified campaign expense. Finding number two is the audit staff's identification of excessive contributions. The majority of these excessive contributions have been resolved as a result of refunds issued or via a notification for presumptive contributions for reattribution. The recommended amount due for the remaining excessive contributions is $60,000. Finding number three is the audit staff's identification of expenses in Iowa over the Iowa spending limit. The Iowa spending limit was exceeded by $162,000. The recommended pro rata repayment on this is approximately $27,000. And finding number four are stale dated checks that were identified by the audit staff, totaling approximately $12,000. And this would be the amount due to the Treasury as well. Thank you, and we can answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Commissioner Weintraub.
Council have anything to say before I launch?
Okay. Down.
I suspected not, but I thought. first of all, I want to thank the auditors on both this matter and the last matter. And these audits are dreadful for us to go through, and I know that's a small fraction of how dreadful it is for you to do them in the first place.
It's what we do.
I know. And actually, the irony is, Joe, that I know that you actually enjoy doing that, which is
scary,
mind-boggling,
isn't it?
To me. Yes, it's truly mind-boggling to me. But so I really do appreciate all the work that went into this. I do have a couple of concerns on finding one and finding three. And again, this just goes to back to some of the things I was saying earlier about fairness. Fairness to people who participate in this process and my concern that they be treated comparably to other folks who've been through the process before and that they have some sense that they can predict how they're going to be treated based on how people were treated before. With respect to finding one, there are finding one includes $128,105 that we didn't tell them about when we were at the PAR. That's allocable expenditures that the audit report says were paid after the candidate's date of ineligibility and considered as non-qualified campaign expenses. And my understanding is that those are bills that were incurred before the date of ineligibility but didn't get paid until after the date of ineligibility, which was determined by the fact that Dick Gephardt stood up and said, I'm out, I'm done, after the Iowa caucuses, although he didn't have to. He could have, you know, hung in there for a while and waited for his bills to come due and all that. And we could get into a very exciting discussion of how NOCOs and NICWIs are figured out here, but this was an oversight on our part that when we issued the PAR to the committee, we did not factor in this $128,000. We knew about it. We didn't factor it in. And there are some expenses that we knew about that we couldn't account for precisely, like the winding down costs. We didn't know then at the PAR exactly how much the winding down costs would be. But this was a set figure that we did know about then, and we did not tell them that we were going to be considering that to be non-qualified. And I think just as a matter of fairness, that we should not at this juncture be telling them that they have an extra $128,000 that they need to worry about that they didn't think they needed to worry about. So as I said, you know, we could, you know, I'm not saying that we have absolutely no legal authority to include that number, although I could make that argument. I think the simpler argument is that, you know, we just, as a matter of fairness, shouldn't include that because we didn't tell them about it at the juncture when they would have normally expected to be informed about it. The other fairness issue that comes up here has to do with finding three. And that is simply that this issue has come up before, and when Bob Dole exceeded the Iowa spending limit, he wasn't asked for a repayment. And maybe he should have been, but he wasn't. And if he wasn't, it seems sort of unfair to ask Dick Gephardt to repay the money now. As I said, I think it's really important that we treat comparably situated candidates the same, that people can look back at what we've done in the past and have some sense of what we're going to do in the future. And, you know, we had several opportunities to where we looked at that issue and debated whether to amend the rules and whether to clarify it and look to Congress, and they didn't do anything about it. And, you know, the bottom line is that the last time this came up, we did not ask for a repayment. And I recognize that the auditors recommended that we ask for a repayment, and they're being perfectly consistent here. But you know, that wasn't the result, and I think that in fairness to this general committee that, or I guess this primary committee, that we should treat them the same way. So those are my two issues. I think we ought to deduct $128,105 from the $378,408 in finding one, and I think we ought to eliminate finding three.
Thank you. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had circulated to my colleagues some material that I had from the very happy experience of the Dole audit, there were some complex issues relating to the interaction or the comparison between the general election funding statute and the primary funding statute that I addressed at that time, and it is. Frankly, lost both to my memory and to my records as to why we did what we did in terms of Iowa. And I don't know if Mr. Stoltz has any recollection as to whether there was any, you know, I know completely what we did as to the overall spending limit, and I've shared that with my colleagues, but I just, I'm in agreement with Commissioner Weintraub in terms of we ought to treat people the same way, but if we know or can dredge up any rationale behind the Iowa decision, it would probably be better, at least so we can understand what mistake we were repeating, if indeed that's what we're doing, or what precedent we're following, or however you want to put it.
I went back through some of my papers on that case, and I have the audit report itself and what we said about it there. It says the commission approved staff recommendation to find that the Dole for President Committee exceeded expenditure limit by $53,000. However, as noted in the previous finding, the commission declined to determine that any repayment resulted. The previous finding had to do with the overall spending limit, and it explains that there were three separate motions to approve the repayment, not to approve the payment, and then one to just decide that they were in fact over the spending limit, but there was going to be no repayment. So it references that same discussion. I also have the commissioner secretary's certifications on it, and there isn't any more detail there than there is in the report. So I, like you, other than what is written, do not recall precisely what the discussion was at the time.
And I just note my colleagues would probably understand that the reason it's a puzzle is because the prior discussion that's referred to was based on, at least in part on my memos, which distinguished between the overall spending limit and the state spending limit based on a prior court case. So I can't explain it, nor can I remember it.
And I can't explain it either because I wasn't here, but I just want to treat people the same. It just comes, you know, at this point, it almost doesn't matter to me, you know, unless you want to revisit the issue in a rulemaking or a policy context, I think we can do that. But in this context, for me, the key issue is that the last time this came up, we did not ask for a repayment, and I think it's only fair that we be consistent.
I agree. Any other? Commissioner Von Spakovsky?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly agree on finding three. On the $27,000. I'm not sure I can agree on finding one for the simple fact that I think, Commissioner Weintraub, what you want us to do is kind of fudge on the regulation. And I'm not quite sure how we can do that because, I mean, the regulation in question for the NOC, which is 9034.5A, basically says that you've got to do it as of the date of your ineligibility. And the date of ineligibility is outlined in 9033.5. And there's not really much room for doubt in that regulation. I mean, it says the date of ineligibility is the date you publicly announce. And he did that. So I think the auditor was absolutely correct in fixing the date they were supposed to do that. I think you're making an equity argument, which, as you know, in many cases I very much listen to. But I'm not sure how we can apply that here because this reg is so very, very specific on that issue. I mean, it seems like a very mechanical. This is the NACO, whatever the acronym is that we use for it. This is a very mechanical application based on the reg, and I guess I don't quite see how we can bring this equity argument into it to say that they haven't violated the regulation.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, I think that I could make the argument, and indeed the Gephardt campaign did make the argument, that it should be excluded in any event because the obligations were already incurred as of the date of ineligibility. Frankly, you know, when I was discussing with colleagues, my sense was that people felt more comfortable with the due process argument, that that it was unfair to the committee to tell them at the par that, you know, they had certain liabilities that they needed to be concerned about, and, you know, then they budget accordingly, and they handle their fundraising and whatever in a certain expectations, and you know, then at the final we said, oops, sorry, we forgot about another $128,000. Too bad. You know, I think that we can certainly do that on due process grounds, and I'm comfortable doing it in particular because I think there is also a good substantive argument underlying it that, you know, if you want to get into the incredibly arcane and exciting world of NOCOs and, you know, bills being incurred as opposed to bills being paid, and I also think that the committee made a good argument that, you know, the Gephardt campaign, Mr. Gephardt certainly could have just, you know, not announced when he did that he was pulling out. He could have just done very little and said he was thinking about it and waited for his bills to come in and paid them off, and then he would be in a substantially better position in the view of our auditors than he is today. And that is a very bizarre incentive system that we are setting up for candidates. But I'm comfortable doing it just based on the equities, just doing it based on the due process argument that we didn't tell them at the par. It's a little late in the day for us to be bringing up another six-figure repayment form. You know, you may find that persuasive or not. I find it persuasive.
We can have.
Yeah, and I do. I think that this there's value in sort of treating these issues consistently across time, and you know, there's certainly a number of different ways to read these regulations, and we're sort of struggling through the most appropriate one. But I'm entirely comfortable with that outcome. Commissioner Walther, are you seeking
recognition? My only concern is that just as a matter of precedent, if we miss something at one point, and can we never go back and bring it up again? What would be an equitable way to do that that would work, I guess? You know, just to say that, well, we didn't bring it up earlier, therefore, we never can do it again. And I guess I worry a little bit about, and I'm interested in your how the cutoff period works in all instances. I mean, if somebody writes a check and it's not cleared and it's still an obligation, it's not paid, and I mean, how fair would that be?
Well, if they've written it,
there's a lot of slush in between the final payment and the final getting the bill, and yeah, the bill, send me the bill, and then the bill doesn't come in time, and so the time is up, and how strict should do you think in fairness it should be applied?
Well, if the check had been written, we would be looking at it as paid, so you don't really get that question. What you can get, of course, is business cycles and vendor billings and things that happen in the campaign while this is all going on. The date of ineligibility is set by regulation. It happens. On that day, the matching fund system changes substantially. As up until that date, the only cap on how much you can get in matching funds is the 50% of the spending limit statutory cap and, you know, your ability to raise money. After that day, there is a third factor that comes in, and that is what do you have in qualified campaign expenses and wind down to pay, and that's the limit. And when that comes into play, things change. Can it be argued that a candidate might manipulate things by staying in longer, getting out earlier? Yeah, I think that's a possibility. However, you know, the way the regulations are set up, this is the outcome when a candidate decides that I've taken my shot and I'm going to get out of the race.
Commissioner Weintraub, I'm sorry, and then Commissioner von Spakovsky. I just
wanted to point out that this is sort of the flip side of the state expenditure limit issue, because the reason that these bills are at issue is not only they were unpaid, but they were in excess of the spending limit for Iowa, and you know, so it's another aspect of the same problem, which, as I said before, we didn't order a repayment for a previous candidate, so I feel uncomfortable doing it here.
Very good. Commissioner von Spakovsky.
Well, I mean, I share the concern that Commissioner Walter expressed. I mean, a preliminary audit is exactly that, a preliminary audit. And given the fact that the committee can, you know, certainly ask for administrative review, it's, you know, a due process argument comes up when you're going to make a holding against someone that they haven't had an opportunity to defend against. They haven't had an opportunity to present evidence on their side that would go against the finding. And I don't think that's the situation here. I think we would be unduly prejudicing ourselves if we issue a ruling that says that if we don't catch absolutely every single item and every single dollar in a preliminary audit, well, we certainly can't consider it at the final audit stage. If we're going to do that, the preliminary audit might as well be the final audit. And I just don't find that persuasive. The other issue I would bring up about this, and again, my auditors would chime in here. If I understand the argument the committee is making correctly, I think they were arguing that only 11% of the 128,000 that we consider non-qualified was actually non-qualified, and therefore there ought to be a reduction of 114,000. Is that's essentially the argument, right, Joe?
Their analysis of this, which is certainly different than what we have seen in the past, suggests that since they exceeded the limit by about 11%, that every disbursement attributable to the Iowa limit from the first to the last should be considered to have exceeded the limit by 11%, including those which were unpaid at the date of ineligibility. So then if you were going to remove the payables from the NOCO statement, you would do it at 11% rather than 100%. It is certainly a new concept or a different concept than we've had argued before. I find that it also has some rather peculiar results, because it would assume that some of the early disbursements that were made, you know, when things were just getting started, after the fact are determined to have been at least partially over the spending limitation. There's no sort of temporal facet to how the budgets are worked and how things are incurred and paid as you go on through the campaign.
Yeah, I think also, if I understand this argument correctly, if you extend this argument logically that the committee is making, if they're saying that only 11% of all outstanding debt should be treated as non-qualified, all outstanding debt, well then don't you have to logically say that 11% of all the other expenses that were already paid was also non-qualified, and add that figure to get an accurate figure of everything here?
Well, the 11% of the total would times the repayment ratio would bring you still to the 27,000 we talked about a little earlier. So it doesn't really affect that calculation. They're still over by the same amount. The only thing it would do is it would allow them to restore as a qualified campaign expense payable 89% of the Iowa bills that were unpaid as of the date of ineligibility.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we seem to have a disagreement here. I mean, the point that sticks with me is the fact that we've got a regulation that says you're ineligible when you withdraw, and that's the exact circumstances here. And I guess I just don't see how we get around that fact.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub?
I just want to clarify. Do I gather that does the $114,000 figure feel better to you, or are they both equally unacceptable alternatives? Because if I would get your vote, Commissioner Von Spakovsky, I would be willing to adopt the $114,000 figure based on the 11%, 89%, as opposed to the 128 $100,000. If I'm not going to get your vote either way, then I will stick with 128, and you know, and then you can make a substitute motion to put it all back in, and I won't vote for that, and then we'll be left with, you know, the situation of are we going to approve the audit report or not. And so that's my suggestion for how we would proceed.
Yes, I'm sorry, Commissioner Von Spakovsky, please.
I don't know. Like I said at the beginning, I mean, I agree that finding three we shouldn't go with, but I guess it seems to me that the audit division did the calculation of the NACO correctly according to our regulation.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I guess I'll make a motion, and maybe you'll make a substitute motion, and we'll just sort of play it out and see how it goes. So, Mr. Chairman, I will move to adopt the findings of the report of the Audit Division on Gephardt for President, Inc., as set forth in Agenda Document 0730, with the exception that I move to amend the report to reject the repayment in Finding 3, and also to subtract $128,105 from Finding 1.
Very good. Commissioner Weintraub has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Madam Secretary, if you could record that Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-1, with the Chairman, Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Walther voting in favor, and Commissioner Von Spakovsky voting against. So, I'm sorry, Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Chairman, if I could, I'd like to ask that the record reflect that because the motion was made with regard to both findings, that's why I voted no. But I would have supported a motion eliminating Finding 3 if that had been offered by itself.
Okay, very good. The record will reflect, and I appreciate your willingness to truncate our meeting here somewhat today to accommodate.
And I appreciate your support for at least part of the motion.
Okay. And I'd like to thank our audit staff and our attorneys for their time and commitment in this matter. The last item on our agenda today involves the FY 2007 reallocation of funds. This is here on Commissioner Walther's objection. Commissioner Walther?
But I've had a chance to talk to our CFO on some of these issues, and I'm comfortable with going ahead. I was mostly concerned with getting enough information because it seemed sparse to me in terms of the implications for the next couple of fiscal years, since there's a number of items here that would give the impression that they are just interim expenses, and there's going to be more to come, and there's going to be some major shifts in our spending. And so I just wanted to get a feel for what our CFO was looking at in addition to the descriptions that we'd already had. And there was a part of our one of the line items said part of our annual requirement, and I was curious to know why this would not just be in our annual budget. And I'm told now that in the future those items will be in our annual budget, even though it wasn't in this case. Anytime we have an annual full obligation, they'll have it in our major budget. So I'm comfortable going ahead and approving the I think it was the $783,000 reallocation.
Okay, very good, Madam Secretary. Then if you could have the record reflect that Agenda Document 07-40 has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. The last item on our agenda is management administrative matters. Mr. Siegman, do we have any such matters?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, there are no matters at this time.
Very good. And with that, we bring the meeting to a close. Thank you.